Buddhist Summer School, Monday, 18th August 1986. Just as no two leaves on a tree are absolutely identical, so too no two persons are identical in all respects. I keep repeating this fact that each person is unique, because this uniqueness has several important consequences, not only for the individual, but also for the whole human race. When we seriously consider something written or spoken, intending to understand the truth underlying it, the brain talks back silently as we read the written word or hear the spoken word. It may say, "Yes, I see," or "I do not understand," or "It may be so," or "That is not true," or "It is just nonsense," or "I agree," or "How can that be?" or "Wonderful, that's just what I need," etc., etc. But you'll find the brain talking back all the time. All these reactions by the brain disclose how it has been conditioned. The nature of the conditioning is laid bare, but we remain unaware whether the reaction conveys the truth of the matter or not. Suppose you read or hear, "Siddhartha Gautama became the perfectly self-enlightened one, the Sammasambuddha." All of us here will say, "Yes, indeed." Why do we say this? Is it not because we have been conditioned by repeatedly hearing or reading that Siddhartha Gautama became the Sammasambuddha, that we react with the positive affirmation, "Yes, indeed"? Could that affirmation have been made in the 15th century if questioned by Thomas da Torquemada, 1420-1498, the Spanish Inquisitor General, knowing that a fiery end would have been the likely consequence? Yes, it could have been made, if you are the stuff that martyrs are made of. But would you then have affirmed a truth which was not a mere belief or opinion, but was your own actual realization? It is a little bit like this. Just as a great musician can recognize the composition of another musician for what it is actually worth, so too we have to have deep realization in order to know for ourselves when we say, "Yes, indeed, Siddhartha Gautama was the Sammasambuddha." You may say, "But I have looked into his life and teachings as dispassionately and impartially as possible, and I find that he and his teachings answer most satisfactorily to his title of Sammasambuddha." The sincerity of your answer is in no doubt, and yet, is it truth? Consider another case, the teaching of rebirth or reincarnation. It will be said, more than half the world believes it. Some people say they have proof of it, namely, that there are people who remember their past lives, the place and time of their births, the events that took place, and they recognize others who played a part in the past, but who are and who are now present, carrying on from the past, etc., etc. Lots of pieces of so-called evidence can be produced. Furthermore, it was discovered on investigation that such events did take place in the past. Therefore, rebirth must be true. The factual details of the past events need not be challenged. But is it actually a case of the past lives of these very people? Are there no other explanations possible for the phenomenon? Explanations nearer the truth than rebirth or reincarnation of those particular existential beings? It may be said, but we have the authority of the Buddha, of Sri Krishna, and of many of the world's great spiritual teachers and philosophers who affirmed rebirth. Did the Buddha, Sri Krishna, or most of the great Upanishadic teachers ever put this down in writing? The written records come into being long after the lifetimes of the great teachers, and they were written by people belonging to a race which implicitly believed in the popular conceptions of rebirth and reincarnation. Moreover, how is it that great religions like Zarathustrianism, Judaism, Christianity and Islam have flourished without the belief in rebirth? If it was such a very essential, indispensable fact, a truth, then these religions could not have flourished. Consider the Buddha's own teaching regarding authority, beliefs, tradition, and scriptural teaching. Now look you, Kalamas, he says to the people of Kesaputta, do not be misled by report, tradition, hearsay, proficiency in or authority of the Pitakas. Now that's a tremendous thing to say, of the Pitakas. By mere logic or inference, etc., or out of respect for a recluse who holds it. When you know for yourselves, these things when performed are conducive to sorrow and loss, then do you reject them. But if conducive to profit spiritually and happiness when performed, then abide by them. So much from the Buddha for all authorities, apart from when you know for yourself. This has immense implications. How do we come to accept the doctrine of rebirth? Is it by knowing for ourselves? Or is it by being told authoritatively by parent or teacher or priest or friend, or by reading about it in a religious text or philosophical treatise? Surely it is the latter, not because we know it for ourselves. If it were by knowing for yourself, it implies that you are not confined to vijnana, discriminative analytical consciousness, characterizing the isolative, separative self-consciousness of the subhuman stage. The doctrine of rebirth, as popularly conceived and understood, is so seductively attractive. It promises you complete success and aeonian time to reach a desired goal, namely to become an enlightened being realize ineffable peace, to enter and enjoy a state of transcendental bliss. In short, to gain all the spiritual lollipops that your self-oriented desire craves to taste. The form in which rebirth is presented supports the egoistic longing for the endless continuity of a separate, identifiable entity, the isolated self. Thus, there is the conditioning of the mind which blocks the realization of that unshakable freedom of mind which is the goal, the pith, the culmination of the Brahmacharya, as the Buddha affirmed in the Greater Discourse to the Monks, the Mahasaropama Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 197, and again in the Lesser Discourse, the Chula Saropama Sutta, to Pingala Kocha. I mentioned yesterday that as you observe the body, the conjoining of the masculine and feminine elements of the psyche gives rise to the knowledge of your own uniqueness and to the ways of your own self. Knowing this, it becomes easy to know the ways of other selves, of mankind. With deeper observation, samasati, that knowledge flowers into pure understanding, cleansing the psyche of its conditioning. And then it is seen that because each one of us is unique, we must discover truth in our own unique way. You know that if you pour water into differently shaped glass vessels, you will see the water in so many shapes. No one can say that this is the one and only true shape of the water. When the psyche is empty of all its clobber, truth, the pure mind, comes upon you and suffuses your whole being in your own unique way. That is why the one truth has so many different expressions, all of which truly represent and convey the truth. The truth is shapeless, formless, substanceless. It is transcendent, thoughtless, and wordless. It affects our innermost consciousness, which is also transcendent, shapeless, formless, substanceless. This consciousness is not just vijnana, discriminative, worldly consciousness, functioning in dependence upon the senses and the brain. This consciousness is vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato bhavam. Consciousness which is signless, characterless, endless, everywhere shining. It is utterly free, independent, holistic consciousness, which enables the psyche to form a conception or conceptions which clothe the truth, give it substance, form, and shape. At this point, you are conscious of the truth in your own unique way. You do not merely hold beliefs or have ideas about the truth. You are really conscious of the truth. And in being really conscious, you have become that truth. Your brain formulates the truth in concept and word uniquely. Although all who speak your language use the same vocabulary and may readily accept your formulation. When you realize the truth for yourself, then your formulation will also be unique. In this process, vijnana is first silenced. After the existential being is transmuted by the truth, by the activity of the primordial creative energy, this transmuted vijnana functions again, giving rise to your clothing of the truth. The clothing, concept and word, is not the essence which is truth, but only your clothing of it, which nevertheless is your link with the truth. The truth itself remains hidden within the sanctum of holistic consciousness. I can't explain this at present anyway. You are conscious of the thing, and that consciousness as such defeats all expression in the shape of concepts and words. But once it is realized, it is a permanent influence for good, for you and for the environment. Procreation is true to type. Ants generate ants only, and human beings generate human beings only. Creation brings into being something utterly new. That is why the great mysticisms and philosophies of religion have said that creation brings out of the nothing. In the Kabbalah they use the term the mystical nothing, the whole of the universe. And the Sankhya philosophy also has a similar idea, which they express in these terms. Purusha, the masculine person, the eternal person, by mere presence influences prakruti, matter, and the activity of prakruti, which is both positive and negative, brings forth the manifested universe. These are very difficult things to see clearly. One believes that, oh yes, I've understood that, but I haven't. I've spent 60 years trying to understand this. But that is how they put it. Procreation is confined within the mortal context of time and space. Creation belongs to the immortal context of infinity and eternity. The uniqueness of all the products of the mortal context is limited by the characteristics of the type. The uniqueness of creation is transcendental, free and unlimited. None of the constraints which inhibit the mortal context apply to creation's uniqueness, undifferentiated and yet holding in potentiality an infinite variety of differentiated uniquenesses awaiting manifestation. These find expression insofar as each one of us awakes to his own uniqueness. Thus, another deep purpose of human existence is fulfilled. In addition to enabling holistic consciousness to emerge as the culmination of the evolution of vijnana, discriminative consciousness. I remember Yes, 62 years ago, talking with those who were with me at Trinity in Cambridge about these things, the evolution of consciousness. And all that happened was that they felt, oh well, you see, Mehta is an Indian, and of course he will talk like that. Whereas vijnana is dependent on sense functioning and on the brain, as well as the nature of the development of the psychophysical organism, holistic consciousness is independent of these factors. In its own transcendental context, it actualizes through its functioning the freedom, which is absolute freedom, for the full-fledged human, and which is the crowning fulfillment of human spiritual development. You may ask, what has all this to do with the Buddha's teachings? A very pertinent question indeed. The Buddha declared positively, Majjhima 140, formally, that is, right from the beginning, from the first utterance of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutra, as well as now, I simply lay down because dukkha and the deliverance from dukkha. He saw and taught that we humans were in an ill state, uneasy, suffering, in bondage, in misery. He saw the origination of it all and the way to realize freedom and peace. What sort of peace? That sublime, unoriginated peace which passes all worldly, vijnanic understanding. This, his eightfold way, is the middle way. Middle does not mean a golden mean in the Aristotelian sense. It is not a compromising with or striking a balance with evil. The middle way is the Majjhima Patipada, which is no other than a perfect way to a transcendental realization, not a whit less than his own realization of Nibbana, his own status of arhatship. And he insisted always on referring to himself as an arahant, to the unsurpassable state for a human creature, the Samma Sambuddha. In his own words, in the very first sermon, he says, the deathless has been found. And that deathlessness, despite the illness and death of the existential psychophysical organism, Gotama, the son of Suddhodana and Mahamaya, was and is the immortal deathlessness which was real. As real, that is, as true as the infinite eternal source of all manifestation. Siddhartha Gautama discovered and realized his own uniqueness. He says when he meets Upaka on the high road between Gaya and the boat tree, there is no one like me. Now if somebody today in this country were to say there is no one like me, in the sense that I am number one, people would say, oh, I see, I see. All his teachings are just the clothing of that uniqueness, the culminating fulfillment of which was and is the transcendental Samma Sambuddha. I trust you see now the relationship between all that was said earlier and the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha taught as no one else taught. Each and every one of the great teachers, the perfected holy ones, taught as no one else taught. You will, if you study all the religions as such, you will discover how extraordinarily original is the presentation by each of the great teachers. All of them were the truth embodied, transcendence incarnate. And transcendence incarnates the moment each one shines uniquely by the quenchless light of his realized uniqueness. You are the world, and the world is you, individually. Your light brightens the world's light, and the world's light sustains your light. To discover and bring your uniqueness to fruition is an important part of spiritual development and religious living. Your uniqueness is some ability or faculty which is inherent in the organism. It should not be an ambition which is imposed on you by anyone. For example, your parents wanting you to become a doctor or lawyer, etc. Or which arises from greed. For example, I will become a film star and make millions. Or which is the consequence of hate. For example, I will lead my armies and ravage your country to avenge the murder of our envoys. You know, this happened with Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan was the chieftain of a small place called Karakoram by the Gobi Desert. And there were about 250,000 inhabitants there. But he was a great military expert and he trained an army. But he was also anxious that Karakoram should become a center of culture like Peking or any of the other great cities known in those days. So he sent out envoys. This happened, I think, 1218, somewhere there. One of the places to which he sent envoys was known as the Khwarezmian Empire. That is south and eastwards from the Caspian Sea and the Aral Sea. The Khwarezmia extended like that, you see. The Khwarezmians, out of extraordinary conceit and folly, fell upon the envoys and slaughtered them. Genghis Khan said, "I'll show you." He gathered his horsemen, his armies, and absolutely exterminated everything that opposed him. He became master of Peking, he became master of the whole of the Khwarezmian Empire, and finally, at the Battle of Liegnitz, he defeated a mixed army of Poles and Sicilians under Frederick II. That's what he did. He had his own morality about it. He always sent a warning to the inhabitants of the village or villages through which he passed that if they allowed him free passage and supplied food and other necessities, if they could, that is, you see, they would be unharmed. But if they didn't, he said, man, woman and child would no longer exist. And he kept his word till he reached the Dnieper, the river Dnieper, an empire which was approximately 7 million square miles in area. What sort of lines of communication did he have to build such an empire? in those days. But there you are, extraordinary cruelty as the consequence of hate engendered by the insult to his envoys. Your uniqueness may be some talent in art or science or philosophy, or it may lie in some simple skill in the common things of daily life, such as cookery or carpentry, gardening or decorating, sewing or mending things, etc. There are scores and scores of such spheres of activity. And if your gift finds expression, you will enjoy both worldly satisfaction and maybe spiritual satisfaction. If what you do is done as unto transcendence, consider, for instance, Ikebana. You go through all the stages of its study and practice, not for gratifying vanity or for exalting your ego, or merely for the sake of ephemeral pleasure. You do it for it demonstrates the beauty of pure and selfless living, that is, religious living. Heaven and earth and humankind are all involved in it, and the beauty of transcendence shines through it because of your uniqueness, which ultimately is the uniqueness of transcendence itself. You can never measure the incalculable consequence of what may seem to be only a trifle. Call to mind the timely, life-saving deed of Sujata, the daughter of the village headman of Uruvela, and her maidservant Punna. Sujata's special skill lay in preparing a nourishing meal with milk. When Gotama decided to refrain from continuing with his terrible austerities which nearly killed him, and desired to regain health and strength, it was Sujata who prepared the meal which restored him, who became the Sammasambuddha. She was the skillful and blessed cook who preserved the life of him who showed the way to salvation and supreme fulfillment, to Nibbana. Recall Sujata with overflowing gratitude when you fill the bowls of the venerable bhikkhus at midday. When your uniqueness, don't ever try to measure it, serves a fellow human being's need, its consequence may be ordinarily helpful or it may be transcendentally fruitful. Remember Sri Krishna's teachings in the Bhagavad Gita. Yoga is skill in action. It's in the second discourse, verse 50. And thy business is with the action only, never with its fruits. Therefore, it has to be selfless action. So let not the fruit of action be thy motive, nor be thou to inaction attached. How often have women, steeped in despondency, said, "What use am I? I am merely a housewife and a child bearer." But if your child, without your desiring it to be so, turns out to be a Gotama or a Jesus, a Kalidasa or a Shakespeare, a Leonardo or a Beethoven, or just your own sweet beloved son or daughter, transcendence itself embodied, the miraculous product of a universal conspiracy. Ah, then indeed, what use have you been? Don't let the brain fumble about trying to answer the question. Be faithful to life's action. Life eternal is the eternal good. Fidelity to life's action links our considerations to karma. Karma is work, and work is life. We have to work in order to live in the world. What work shall we do? How shall we earn our living? The Buddha's Eightfold Way includes Samā Ājīvo, the perfect means of livelihood. This cuts out all those means of livelihood which go against the sīlas, and particularly in the modern world, they are legion, such as those which hurt or destroy living beings and creatures, which go against wisdom, which pander to our lusts and delusions, and which are destructive to ourselves and harmful to others. Karma means not only daily work in the world, but also sacred work. The Vedic people observed a large number of external sacrificial rituals. The Upanishadic teachers inaugurated a great spiritual change. From external ritual, they moved into the inner life. In the Gita, we have one of the sublimest conceptions of man. All life is action, but every little action should be performed in the spirit of sacrifice to the infinite eternal. The finite and temporal, which is mortal, longs for the infinite and eternal, which is immortal. The essence of the vision of the great spiritual teachers is the vision of transcendence in all things and all things in transcendence. In that marvelous third great poem of the Divina Commedia, the Paradiso, Dante sang, "Within its deep infinity I saw ingathered and bound by love in one volume, the scattered leaves of all the universe." The universal form of this complex whole, I think that I saw, because as I say this, I feel my joy increasing. And it's a very interesting fact that all the great world teachers emphasize the fact that you will find joy and happiness in living the good human life. The Buddha assures the mendicant Pottapada of joy and happiness and peace after he has given a long discourse about all the stages. Then he ends up, "Now it may well be, Pottapada, that you think evil dispositions may be put away, the dispositions that tend to purification may increase, one may continue to see face to face and by himself, and by himself come to realize the full perfection and grandeur of wisdom, but one may continue sad." Now that, Pottapada, would not be accurate judgment. When such conditions are fulfilled, then there will be joy, and happiness and peace, and in continual mindfulness and self-mastery, one will dwell at ease. This comes in the Digha Nikaya 196. And to joy or bliss, I would add beauty. William Sharp, who wrote under the pseudonym Fiona MacLeod, wrote these lines: I dreamed of Orchil, the dim goddess who is under the brown earth in a vast cavern, where she weaves at two looms. With one hand she weaves life upward through the grass, with the other she weaves death downward through the mould. And the sound of the weaving is eternity, and the name of it in the green world is time. And through all, Orchil weaves the weft of eternal beauty. Eternal beauty that passeth not, though its soul is changed.